back to Gray Matters, the podcast of the Seaboard and Gray Center for the Study of the Administrative State. I'm Jace Linton, the Center's Research Director. Today's episode is a rebroadcast of the webinar we hosted on April 29th to discuss the pending cert petition in Senico versus City and County of Honolulu. At issue in the case is whether state tort law is an appropriate way to address concerns about climate change and whether the Clean Air Act preempts such cases. Our co-executive director, Jen Mascott, moderated the discussion between law professors Jonathan Adler and Richard Epstein, Solicitor General of Alabama Eddie LaCour, and our other co-executive director, Adam White.
Okay, good afternoon. Thank you for joining the Gray Center today. We're here for a very important discussion about a petition that is currently before the Supreme Court for its consideration as to whether to take up a case that would be reversing potentially a decision by the Hawaii Supreme Court that gets to fundamental questions about the interaction between federal power and state power. And in this case, whether in state court, the local jurisdictions within Hawaii can bring suits against big producers of fossil fuels and energy companies about international and interstate emissions that are allegedly causing climate change. And so one of the questions is whether a federal law preempts state law, meaning that because federal law generally is seen as the forum for the regulation of interstate commerce, does that mean that such claims need to be heard in federal court or under federal law? And then a second question, perhaps, that our panelists will discuss is, regardless of whether there is whether federal law could preempt such claims, whether the state of Hawaii actually affirmatively would have the power to hear such claims, even in the absence of common law or federal law that are regulating this area of emission. So we have four experts today, a number of whom have filed briefs in the case, none of whom are involved in representing the lead litigants, but a number of whom have filed amicus or what we call friend of the court briefs. So we'll start first with Adam White from American Enterprise Institute, and also co-director with me at the Gray Center, and a longtime administrative law scholar and expert on issues like this and regulation of all kinds. And then we will hear from John Adler, who's an environmental law and administrative law expert at Case Western Reserve, who's one of our most frequent Gray Center participants over the years through his writing and his analysis in forums like this. We'll also hear from Eddie LaCour, who has a brief representing the position of the state of Alabama as a friend of the court in this case, and we'll talk about some of these legal issues from the perspective of state law. Interestingly, Alabama has filed a brief on the side of the petitioners who want the Hawaii Supreme Court decision to be reviewed rather than on the side of Hawaii here. So we'll hear a little bit about how states might view this case in contrast to the federal government and why some states might have disagreements, perhaps, about how these legal issues should be analyzed. And then we will close with the always expert Richard Epstein from NYU, also a longtime favorite of the Gray Center's. And so hopefully have a vigorous discussion about the issues before the court potentially hear, and also what the panelists think are the likelihood that the Supreme Court is going to actually agree to hear this case. One final note, where the case now stands is essentially litigants tried to do what's called remove the case from state court to federal court and essentially lost on that. And then we're back within Hawaii state courts, at which point the companies being sued raised the question about whether the state court actually had the power to hear the claims. And perhaps unsurprisingly, similarly to how administrative agency tribunals often believe they have the power to hear claims, the state Supreme Court in Hawaii believes that the state courts here have the power to hear the claims and evaluate the law. And we will figure out whether our panelists agree and whether there are important issues here that the Supreme Court needs to review to make sure at least that law in this area is being applied uniformly throughout the country. So, Adam, let me kick off with you.
Great. Thanks, Jen. And thanks, everybody, for joining us today for this conversation. In case it's not already obvious, it's a pair of cases right now, Sunoco versus City and County of Honolulu and Shell versus City and County of Honolulu. Case number is 23947 and 23952. It's a very interesting pair of cases, the most recent iteration of cases around climate change policy and the powers of federal governments, state governments, and the private stakes for companies that are being regulated. So this entire dispute arose, I guess, most directly when it was filed in state court in Hawaii in March of 2020. The city and county of Honolulu filed a lawsuit against 15 different energy companies, alleging that those companies' operations, their emissions of greenhouse gas emissions, directly harm Honolulu by exacerbating causes sea level impacts, physical impacts that give rise to loss of financial assets in Hawaii. So the case was filed in state court in Hawaii rather than federal court in 2020. There was initially a dispute over whether this case should be heard in state court at all. There was an attempt to remove federal court. Eventually, the case was remanded back to state court. A cert petition went up to the Supreme Court to consider the removal issue. The court did not grant that cert petition. The court heard the case and eventually ruled that these companies were liable for, or can be held liable for, their contributions to climate change. The Hawaii Supreme Court rejected claims that the issues are in effect preempted by federal authority through the Clean Air Act. So the case is now up on a cert petition over that basic preemption issue. There have been similar claims or similar disputes around federal common law. Some may recall the AEP case that came out of the Second Circuit a few years ago, where the Supreme Court held that the Clean Air Act replaces federal common law on this issue, but it did not explicitly or squarely resolve the question of federal preemption of state law claims. Now, the petitioners in this case argue in their cert petition that the Hawaii Supreme Court's decision creates a circuit split with the Second Circuit, which in the case of City of New York versus Chevron in 2021 held that these sorts of claims are these state claims are preempted by the Clean Air Act. Now, there's been, I don't know how we'd characterize it, maybe a flurry or a number of cases, similar cases like this, by usually municipalities. For example, the Minnesota Attorney General, Keith Ellison, filed a case against a few companies in state court in Minnesota recently. There was a petition on the question whether that case should be removed to federal court and ended up not being removed. But this case fits alongside other disputes over the power of states to regulate conduct that maybe has impacts within the state, but the claims themselves might have effects beyond the states. I'm thinking about things like personal jurisdiction, the aforementioned removal questions, and of course the Dormant Commerce Clause, in addition to the preemption issue that's now squarely at hand. Now, the argument for preemption goes something like this, and I know Jonathan Adler is going next. Correct me where I'm wrong. The general argument is this: the Clean Air Act implicitly and completely preempts state authority to regulate on these issues outside of the state's own participation in the Clean Air Act framework itself. There's an argument from an analogy. The Supreme Court's past case in the Milwaukee litigation, where they held that the Clean Water Act preempts interstate tort cases like public nuisance. But here the argument is that the similar logic applies to the Clean Air Act. So the Clean Air Act, in completely regulating the issue of interstate air pollution, including here interstate greenhouse gas emissions, but that is the exclusive way in which these emissions can be regulated, not through federal courts outside of the Clean Air Act, not through state courts through tort litigation, but rather exclusively through the Clean Air Act. I have a few thoughts on this case beyond that thumbnail sketch. Maybe I'll just throw them in here. As I've tried to think about the issues more, these are the things that stand out to me. First of all, this reminder, the latest reminder of how difficult it's been to map pre-existing legal doctrines and even legal statutes onto the question of greenhouse gas emissions. Beginning with the Massachusetts versus EPA case, Utility Air Regulatory Group, the aforementioned AEP federal common law case, and on and on. It's been a challenge, I think, to map both decades-old statutes and decades-old legal doctrines onto both the practical practical aspects of greenhouse gas emission regulation, and also the practical aspects of actually litigating these things or regulating these things. And that's my second point, then, is this, that this case is also, I think, highlighting the difficulties in what litigation itself would entail, where you have here a public nuisance case against more than a dozen companies with operations around the world. Just like the impacts around the world, it seems to be very, very hard for a state court to adjudicate claims that will have huge impacts beyond the states, even just in terms of bringing the case in state court, bringing the kind of evidence before a state court judge and then a state Supreme Court. These are national and global issues, and trying to resolve them in a state court, in a county courthouse, is extremely difficult. Also, a challenge around this is the political incentives around this kind of litigation. Setting aside the specific legal claims and the facts at hand, I think it's clear with the trend we're seeing in these cases that there is more and more a political trend in these cases. There seems to be real incentives politically for prosecutors or state attorneys general to bring these kind of claims well beyond the state's borders in state court. And so I think the court is going to have to grapple with what this case means in the overall trajectory of the history of these cases. And then finally, and I think this maybe alludes or is a prelude to Solicitor General LaCour's point later, it's been interesting to watch the state's role in this case, where you have states on the plaintiff side of the case, but also states on the defendant side of the case. And normally we don't think of states as strong defenders of federal authority, but what I see here is the states acting first on the defendant side to defend the state's own authority. And so to the extent that federal power is being invoked here, I see it as primarily as a defense for the state's own interests and sovereignty. I think at the end, this case seems largely about state versus state as much as it is state versus federal authority. Now, I tee all that up primarily to provoke my friend Jonathan Adler. So maybe I'll turn to Jonathan for his account of the case and the issues at hand. Thanks again, Jen, for setting this up.
So Jonathan from Case Western, thanks for joining us. Yes. So Jonathan, sometimes different folks align differently on certain issues, but Jonathan today is a counter voice. So tell us a little bit of different perspective here, Jonathan.
Well, certainly I'll do my best. It's a pleasure to be here with all of you. Pleasure to be part of this discussion about these cases involving tort claims against fossil fuel companies for their emissions of greenhouse gases. Now, I should notice that as an initial matter and as a policy matter, I share a lot of the misgivings that Adam and others have about using the courts as the primary means of setting climate policy. Climate change is something that concerns effectively the management of the global atmosphere and how we should deal with the emissions of greenhouse gases. That's not something that individual judges and individual tort cases are going to handle very well. But as a legal matter, the question that's coming up in these cases and the question that Sunoco and Shell are asking the Supreme Court to consider is whether or not state tort law claims are preempted by federal law in one way or another. And in my own view, the arguments that are being advanced for preemption by Sunoco and its amici are contrary to constitutional and statutory texts, contrary to history, contrary to precedent, and are an invitation of the sort of, for the sort of judicial lawmaking that I think most people on this panel are usually very suspicious of. And however much we may have concerns about the wisdom of this case, the Minnesota case, we should not allow those concerns to justify the sort of unconstrained judicial lawmaking that we generally think should be avoided. So let's start with the text. As we know under the Constitution, under the Supremacy Clause, federal law is supreme, but we also generally understand that does not mean that federal law is some kind of free-floating nullification device that displaces state law willy-nilly, but rather what it means is that when Congress actually uses its authority to legislate, that legislation is supreme, and we wait for Congress to legislate before preempting potentially contrary state law. Here, the only federal law that we have that could preempt state law is the Clean Air Act. And the Clean Air Act is quite explicit. There is an exceedingly broad savings clause in the Clean Air Act that adopts what we see in most federal environmental laws, which is that state tort law is not preempted with the exception of certain types of product standards. The Clean Air Act, by its terms, does not preempt state tort law claims, even those relating to emissions that are expressly regulated, and certainly not in the case of greenhouse gas emissions, which the Clean Air Act was not enacted to address, the Massachusetts versus EPA decision notwithstanding. As Justice Gorsuch wrote in the Virginia uranium case concerning preemption, courts are hardly free to extend a federal statute to a sphere Congress was well aware of but chose to leave alone. For good or ill, Congress has never sought to preempt state efforts to control, regulate, or allow for the litigation against emissions that are regulated by the Clean Air Act. And it's not up to the courts to invent a preemptive portion of the statute that Congress never enacted. In terms of history, it's worth noting that claims in favor of preemption, such as those embraced by the Second Circuit, are based on just a false understanding of the history of environmental protection in this country. Pollution control historically was something that was dealt with by the police power at the state and local level. This is true for air pollution, water pollution, all forms of pollution. And if one looks at that history, the instrument choice question of whether to address pollution through litigation or through administrative regulation was always something left in the hands of state and local governments, and at different points in time for different types of pollutants, both state and local governments would go back and forth between adopting administrative regulation or using litigation, and nuisance litigation in particular, as the primary means of dealing with various types of pollution. So the burst of the nation's first air pollution control statutes at the local level in the late 19th century occurred at the same time as the more aggressive use of public nuisance actions as a way of controlling a potentially harmful pollution in urban areas. They were seen as complements, things that states could choose between depending on what they thought made the most sense. And that's very contrary to the story that the Second Circuit gives, that implies that state and local government's authority to deal with pollution is something that is granted or given or allowed by the federal government. That gets the history exactly backwards. Federal environmental law was enacted against a background of broad state and local regulation, and recognizing that state and local regulation was the dominant means of dealing with environmental concerns. Now, what about legal precedent? You know, there was a time when we had federal common law, what we might call general law, that provided the basis for dealing with interstate pollution claims. That was something that prior to Erie and the development of the Erie Doctrine was understood as part of the federal court's exercise of the judicial power. But post-Erie, that's something the courts abandoned. And in a case called Milwaukee 2 that I'm sure we'll talk about a bunch, the court held that federal common law is displaced by the enactment of pollution control statutes. Not preempted, but displaced. And that's an important distinction because the test for displacement and what displacement does is actually quite different than the test for preemption and what preemption does. What essentially the court said in Milwaukee 2 is that there is no federal rule of decision provided by federal common law anymore. The only federal rules of decision for interstate pollution are those that are provided by the displacing statutes. In Milwaukee 2 was the Clean Water Act. In these cases, it's the Clean Air Act. The court subsequently made clear that displacement means there's no federal common law cause of action, but that pre-existing state law causes of action remain, the only limitation being that a polluter can't be held to a standard different from the one in the place that they are operating. That is quite explicit in the case of Ouellette, that Ouellette allowed these cases to go forward. And in fact, in that particular case, the plaintiffs won a significant settlement as a consequence of that litigation. So the Supreme Court has never understood the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act to fully preempt actions for pollutants, including those that cross state lines. And as the Supreme Court said in the American Electric Power or AEP case, the availability of state lawsuits depends on the preemptive effect of the federal act. And again, the federal act expressly saves pre-existing state court law causes of action, or as Judge Naomi Rao, the founder of this center, put it in her opinion in the D.C. versus Exxon case, quote, when Congress legislates to displace federal common law, the statute governs the extent to which state law is preempted. And again, the Clean Air Act, by its terms, by its express text, does not preempt these sorts of actions. Now, perhaps Milwaukee 2 was a misstep. Richard and I might actually agree that we would be better off back in the general law world where federal common law was how we thought of these sorts of things. And maybe that's the case. But that's not the world we're in. That's not what Supreme Court precedent has held for 50 years. That's not polluters have understood controls their obligations. So just to close up, it's certainly true that Congress can preempt. Maybe Congress should preempt these sorts of cases. But when Congress hasn't done so, it's not for the courts to invent a preemptive law that Congress never enacted. This was actually the lesson of West Virginia versus EPA. However much some might think it would be a good thing if Congress had enacted a comprehensive climate change law, unless and until Congress has done so, other branches of the federal government cannot act as if Congress had. Congress didn't enact the sorts of climate provisions that would authorize the EPA to enact the Clean Power Plan. Congress has not enacted the sort of climate change provisions that would authorize federal courts preempting states' historic role of dealing with pollutants. If the Clean Power Plan presented the sort of major question that should cause us to exercise caution before displacing traditional constitutional baselines, certainly questions of preemption of states' police law powers should as well. Again, if we think these sorts of cases shouldn't go forward, that's a job for Congress to do, not a job for the courts. Thank you for your time, and I look forward to my co-panelists explaining why I'm wrong.
Excellent. Well, thanks so much, Jonathan. We're going to turn next to Eddie LaCour, but just first, just to continue on with some of Jonathan's themes. So obviously, we're talking a lot about does federal law here preempt or supersede state law? Of course, I suppose a threshold answer, like initial question could be, and I think Jonathan, both your and Adam's questions hinted at this, in this particular case, with the scope of these particular claims, as opposed to maybe nuisance claims historically, these crossing state and sometimes international lines, does the state court, does the state law system actually have the power in our federalist system any longer to hear such claims? And if the answer to that, of course, is no, and maybe this is something we can discuss later, do the preemption questions then fall by the wayside because there just wouldn't be initial power even to preempt? And regardless of what the answer is to that question, is that within the scope of the question presented to this U.S. Supreme Court? So I raise this a little bit now because we're about to hear from Eddie LaCour, who is the state solicitor general for Alabama, and has filed an amicus brief along with the attorney general for Alabama in this case, not just on behalf of Alabama, but on behalf of 20 states, Alabama, Alaska, Arkansas, Georgia, Idaho, Montana, North Dakota. I could go on and on. So from many different parts of the country. And so, Eddie, if you could tell us just your general thoughts on the case, but also, you know, maybe counterintuitively here, why is it that so many states are unified behind the position that states just should not actually be able to regulate essentially these claims here, which seems like it would be against state power, and one might assume that states would be in favor of state as opposed to federal power?
Yeah, thank you, Jen. As you mentioned, we had 20 states on the brief, and I think the point we were really trying to get across is that we see this fundamentally as a federalism case, that we want to make sure that states do have the authority to regulate the things that are going on within their own borders, but when you start trying to project that state power out of state, that state law becomes incompetent to govern in that area. We don't see that so much as, or at least the brief does not take the position that that is so much a product of the Clean Air Act, but rather is inherent in the federalism structure of the Constitution. When the states joined the Union, they gave up certain authority as that other sovereign states would possess, for example, going to war with one another. So we have to litigate our disputes now in court. And similarly, when there are fundamentally interstate or federal concerns, those areas have to be governed by federal law, not by state law. And so there are a couple of contexts where this is more familiar to court watchers. For example, boundary disputes between states, water wars, so to speak, where there might be a dispute between a downstream state with how an upstream state is using limited water resources. And in those areas, you don't, like, if Alabama wanted to claim some of the beautiful Florida Panhandle beaches as their own. They couldn't pass the 2024 Alabama Beach Act and then adjudicate that under Alabama law in Alabama courts and claim title to the Florida Panhandle. If we had some legitimate dispute about the boundaries, that would be heard under federal law, under these familiar equitable principles that that the court has applied in boundary disputes and similarly in disputes over water. We think, by the same token, if Hawaii, if you just tweak the facts of the Honolulu case a little bit, and Hawaii had passed a law that set $500 billion of liquidated damages anytime somebody sells or uses gasoline in Alabama. And then they went to Hawaii state court to apply that state law to something that had nothing to do with Hawaii. It clearly can't be how our federal system works. And there are cases, the Milwaukee case was mentioned earlier, where that was a dispute over interstate water pollution. Pollution, I believe, is occurring in Milwaukee, allegedly, flowing into Lake Michigan, and Illinois bringing suit. And the court made clear this is something that needs to be, this demands for applying federal law. And at the time, there was not the Clean Water Act in place, and so the court indicated that federal common law would be what would govern. Later, the Clean Water Act was enacted and displaced federal common law. But I think this is where, I think this is a very important point for understanding understanding our view of the case, that once there is this displacement that occurs, that doesn't mean that these fundamentally federal disputes over a state trying to obtain compensation for something that happened outside of its borders somehow become competent to be judged by state law. It's simply that there's a different federal law that applies. But these are fundamentally federal questions. So the Clean Air Act was essentially Congress deciding that federal common law and one-off litigation is not the best way to regulate the national energy policy and national sort of environmental concerns. We're going to do it instead through this statutory regime, this regulatory regime. And there's no reason to think that Congress's judgment to do that has somehow caused state law to be competent to essentially regulate these same issues. So that's essentially the view of the Hawaii Supreme Court, that previously maybe Honolulu could have brought a federal common law action for emissions that were occurring in Alabama or Texas or somewhere else. The Clean Air Act, and those would have preempted the state law claims. But then once the federal common law was displaced by the Clean Air Act, these state law claims spring back to life or snap back into action. But that gets everything backwards. So the state law was never competent from the beginning of the framing, and it doesn't become competent simply because Congress has come up with a better way to handle these fundamentally federal issues. And I think that's why you do have 20 states who are interested here, too, because if Honolulu or Minnesota or California is able to project its power over what is going on in Alabama or in Florida or in Texas or Alaska, it's going to lead to some potentially very bad outcomes, or at least outcomes that are inconsistent with the policy choices that are being made in these other states. And Honolulu or Hawaii is free to pass laws that that sort of govern what is happening within their boundaries, and that's perfectly fine. But state law is not competent to govern what's happening in the state of Alabama.
Okay, great. Thank you, Eddie, for running through the state perspective or the non-Hawaii state perspective on these issues. And on that note, we'll turn to Richard Epstein. Richard, you have a brief in this case with John Yu. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see the issues here?
Yeah, we see it in a very different way from what has gone on elsewhere. And let me start beginning by figuring out what the particular causes of action were in this case. Jonathan repeatedly referred to this as a case involving the emissions of various kinds of pollutants under traditional public law. of nuisance. This is not what this case is about. If you go back and you read it, all of the traditional nuisance cases, trespass cases, and so forth have been eliminated. I think the basic intuition that they had in Hawaii is that what the Attorney General, what Ed said, is going to be correct, that you will assume that the creation of a federal statute displaces federal common law, but does not essentially bring state law back. Essentially, if you improve the federal law, it doesn't change the balance between the federal and state power. So I think, in effect, there's a real risk, they thought. So what they decided to do is to back off, and this is a case for misrepresentation. And the question then is, what are the elements of misrepresentation and how does it work? Normally, we would say that a misrepresentation case, when it's put forward, is a matter of state law, but you have to look at the elements of the case to see the way in which it goes. And in this particular case, the misrepresentation case that is brought by the state of Hawaii is worthless under any form of general common law, under any form of state law. It is not a misrepresentation case at all. So if you go through the various elements of this particular case and you say to yourself, well, I mean, what is the false statement they made? Well, they didn't make any statement. What they did is they sold gasoline in the state, and they basically told you about its anti-knock properties, but they did not say anything about whether it does or does not promote global warming in any way, shape, or form. So you're trying to find the false statement. In this case, they didn't make any. If you're trying to create a duty in which to speak, there's no such duty that exists anywhere else, unless courts can just pluck duties out of the air and say, we're going to require you to speak. And what they might well say is, we now have a new duty that's, if you want to market this product inside the state, you have to pay us $10 billion for the privilege to do so, as a kind of an ad hoc rule. And so you don't see that. And then the question is, what about causation under these circumstances? Well, here you're talking about disclosing something which is common knowledge to everybody in the face of the world. And the tort of misrepresentation, whenever it's put forward, always deals with asymmetrical information, where a defendant knows something that a plaintiff does not know. So there's a latent defect. And essentially, either you correct the defect or you give information to the other side so that it could alter the kind of behavior that it wants to undertake. But there's nothing here to disclose because everything is complete. Known. Certainly the public officials know it, and certainly the public knows it. So who is it that does not know this? Well, the answer is nobody. So then you're going to try to figure out, well, what's going to be the consequences of all this? Well, as a straight tort matter, if the information is already supplied, what is going to be the change in the consumption of gasoline by virtue of the fact that there's imaginary duty to disclose? And the answer is essentially different. So it may well be that the seas will rise or that lots of other things will happen, but none of that is going to be related to any promotional campaign that has been done. And so the causation case is a dead zero. Well, somebody's going to say, you know what? That's your view, Professor Epstein, but tort law is exclusively a function of the state, and if they want to invent a Meshuggah tort law, crazy tort law, they're entitled to do so. They didn't call it a crazy tort law. They said they were applying traditional principles, which they were not. But there is another element, and I think Eddie basically hinted at this. He says there's a due process issue that's involved, having to do with long-arm jurisdiction, whether or not you can bring into your courts somebody else whose activities take place outside of your jurisdiction with no consequence of fact within it. And so what are they trying to do? They're trying to say, since you sold the stuff in this state, you didn't influence anybody, we're going to treat you as though you're a polluter and that you're responsible for raising the seas and everything else. And what happens is you can't do this. If you look at the cases that the plaintiffs start to talk about where they're establishing minimum contacts, none of them are remotely like this. It's the question, can you sue Ford Motor Company and make the goods in state A, where in fact the injury takes place in state B, where they may not sell the car? And the answer to that question is, of course you establish precedent. You don't have a long-arm jurisdiction problem. But in this case, you have such an extreme problem of arrogation that it completely upsets the balance one way or the other. So then what does Jonathan say that I agree with? I'll just mention this. I'm going to go back a long time as an English common lawyer, and this question about the relationship of statute to private causes of action was raised in the great case of Powell and Fall, great to me, maybe to nobody else, an 1880 case in which the libertarian judge a man named Baron Bramwell, a great thinker, said, look, there is a general statute which tells you how you have to run trains. You have been in compliance with that particular statute, so there's no breach. Nonetheless, you have injured somebody else by direct contact, and we're going to allow the private right of action because compliance with the statute is not an effective way to prevent externalities from happening. And you can say in the Milwaukee case, that was a real pollution case. Stump was coming over from one state into another. You could see it, smell it, taste it, or whatever. But in this case, it's all fix-it. And so you can certainly believe, as I do, that private rights of action ought to supply, but they have to be public nuisance cases. And there are two kinds of public nuisance cases that you could have, and this case is neither of them. You can have cases of real pollution. This is not a pollution case. They don't even claim it's a pollution case. Or you can have blocking a public road or something like this. There's nothing of that sort that's taking place. So essentially what they're saying is the state of Hawaii may make selling gasoline a tort, which holds you liable for the rising of the public seas. This is a complete non-connection. So the correct answer is, what, no matter what you say about the preemption question, this doesn't work. And by the way, on the Erie law, Jonathan doesn't state all the law. There are two other cases that really matter. One is called Hinterleiter, which was decided the same day as Erie, and it preserved federal common law in those cases where there are intergovernmental disputes. And well, that's a terrible decision because it ignored that principle and allowed one state to pass a statute that essentially gave it all the preferences of everybody else. It's a case that ought to be overruled. And then there was the Clearfield Trust case in 1943, which says, of course we use federal law when we're dealing with negotiable instruments because they involve the routine transmission between one state and another. So Erie, in a sense, should not be understood as transforming the world. It should be understood as saying the excesses that took place when people misread Swift against Tyson have to be eliminated. But if you take into account these two very viable exceptions, it doesn't give you this kind of notion that the states are supreme in its own dear. This is a essentially interstate dispute. What they've proved is nothing whatsoever about what is done in every other state. If this theory is good, anybody in the state of Hawaii who uses pollutants of one kind or another could be held responsible, so the state should be suing itself for direct admissions. So I think the answer is the sooner the Supreme Court gets rid of this craziness, the better we will all be, and I think the due process ground is at least as good and probably better than the preemption ground. Thank you.
So on that, before we go on to the next, to give everybody a general chance to respond, Richard, on the due process ground, are you raising that argument as essentially analogous to the argument that states lack power here? Or maybe other panelists can jump in. Or
No, this is essentially
two totally separate things.
This is a straight long arm statute argument. There's no minimum contacts that you have with anybody else. If the only thing that you could claim is that they have basically sold gasoline in your state, but you're not claiming in effect that any basically emissions from that gasoline was appropriate.
Yes, so there's pushback on that a little bit. I mean, I do feel like the court recently, as particularly Justice Gorsuch, there's some skepticism potentially for putting too much in the due process realm. So that might be a route they would go.
Well, I think he's just dead wrong.
But if there's a lack of a state court power or a lack of a cause of action to hear the case in the first place, you also don't even need to reach the due process argument, correct?
Well, I mean, remember,
fundamentally not have power.
The long arm statutes are due process statutes.
No, I know, but I guess I'm saying you don't. Correct. But that requires the court to say it's like a Fifth Amendment constitutional violation of individual rights, basically.
Yeah, that's fine. Look, I mean,
and I'm just simply saying, if the Supreme Court actually reaches a threshold determination, even before that, an antecedent decision that there's just not power of the state courts to hear these claims, which is, it sounds like, is a little bit of a part of Eddie's argument.
It is.
Then they don't have to reach any of these follow-on questions about preemption or find a constitutional violation because there just literally is no power in our system.
Well, the argument is no power because the long-arm statutes are not satisfied. This is not the international suit case where you were selling goods in a particular state where you have special jurisdiction. And so the point is, look, here's my deep disagreement with Justice Gorsuch. He seems to think that judicial balancing is somewhat of an anathema and has said it on multiple times, most recently in connection with the pork case. look, every time you're dealing with dormant commerce clause or with due process, you're always dealing with a balancing situation. And here there's just nothing on the one side of the scale. And so I think, in effect, there should be summary judgment on these grounds. And then when there's actual pollution, if Hawaii can say, hey, you know what Chevron did? It had one of its boats come into our water and admitted all sorts of gunk into the seas, then they could bring a suit in Hawaii for what's going on. But this case is not remotely like that. Look at the cause of action. It is a straight misrepresentation case, and there's not a single element of that particular tort that's satisfied. That's why, in effect, I agree with Eddie, and I assume, Eddie, you would sort of basically say that that's consistent with what you argued as well.
I guess what I'm partly saying is I feel like you're making two arguments, right? Because your final point, your point that there's not a cause of action here that covers it, a state cause of action, is actually a separate ground.
No, you know, that, no.
The reason it doesn't require finding minimum contacts.
Okay, the question is, I think that is perfectly correct. The issue is whether or not a federal court is entitled to say so. And the long arm issue is designed to resolve that ambiguity. But I have the interesting question is, suppose a state court said, as Justice Kagan mentioned in one of her opinions, we decide to impose a tax on you of $1 million to fix a bridge, even though you had nothing to do with the bridge. I would say that's not a tax, right? And so I think you could certainly make that argument that it's a taking. But as far as I'm concerned, what you're telling me is I'm more right than I thought I was, because there are two grounds on which I'm correct, not one.
I'm actually saying, yes, but I'm saying, that it's actually a different, it's not like we in this call are mostly, it seems like, trying to come up with federal reasons why I cannot hear this. And I'm saying maybe it's like, perhaps the court will conceive of it. We'll see if Cannon gets.
Well, I hope they do. I mean,
but that it's even a more structural thing, that it's just within the United States of America, individual states who have ratified that, who have signed onto the Constitution, do not have power in their state courts, period, to be deciding these international...
Let me give it to you one more sentence.
Go ahead.
One sentence, which is, when I wrote my taking books, I said the transformation of a liability rule can easily be a taking. So if you decided to impose liability on Miss Mascot for breathing, and it's going to be $1 million fine, there's no element of a tort, and so therefore she's free. That's what they're doing in this state. There's nothing whatsoever that sounds like a tort. You're missing every element of the cause of action. There's no subtle variation within a standard range on this case. What Hawaii has done in this case is just plain bonkers. And if one wants to do that as a independent claim, it's just plain wrong. Takings overcoming the state law, fine. If you do it, we did it as a minimum contacts law. I'm happy to win any way you can help.
So, Jonathan, thank you, Richard. Jonathan, back to you. Will the court hear this case? Does it need to? And how are some of our other panelists wrong on the fundamental issues here?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, first, it's worth noting, you know, there have been something like 7 or 8 cert petitions on the removal question, which was, among other things, based on a theory of federal preemption. The court has rejected all of those cert petitions, and in the process upheld decisions written by Judge Rao, Judge Bibas, by pretty much every federal circuit without a single dissent. There was one concurrence lamenting the whole area of law by Judge Strauss, but no federal appellate judge that has heard these claims thought the federal preemption arguments, the complete preemption arguments, had any weight to them. The argument here is slightly different because it's a general preemption claim, not a complete preemption claim. There is a split between the Hawaii Supreme Court and the Second Circuit. So insofar as the court were to rediscover the idea that as soon as there is a circuit split, cert should be granted, something the court in recent years has abandoned, then this would qualify. And certainly by the standards that I would normally suggest the court should use, which is to err on the side of giving clarity once there is a circuit split or a split among authorities, then there would be a basis for taking cert on the preemption question, because that's the only area where there's a circuit split. I'm not sure it's necessary, because there are cases out there that raise similar sorts of tort claims that the court did not take cert on before. There's even one from the Second Circuit involving water pollution, the Henry MTBE case, where the Second Circuit allowed claims like this to go forward. But the court certainly could. My own view is that, where I think I disagree with my co-panelists is that the Supreme Court has been very explicit about this. There's a lot more discussion in the various briefs about Milwaukee 3, a decision by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, than there is about International Paper versus Ouellette, which is squarely on point, in which downstream folks sued an upstream polluter, and the upstream polluter said, displacement, preemption, Clean Water Act, you can't sue this. And the Supreme Court said, no, of course they can. What they can't do is impose their standard, substantive standard for conduct that did not occur within their state, but that the case can proceed. And then the question of what sorts of damages and what level and so on is something that you deal with, not at the front end in, with the preemption claim, but at the back end as you go through trial. And that's so 100% on point. And insofar as we view this as an emissions case, just note really quickly, if we don't view this as an emissions case, my underlying sympathies are with Richard in that I don't like this sort of tort claim. But what Hawaii's claim essentially is, and as I know Richard would lament, we see this sort of claim all the time in state courts, is that particular manufacturers sold and marketed a product in a way that caused harm to the public within the relevant jurisdiction. And now again, Richard may not agree that those claims can be proven in a way that is required, consistent with due process. I may agree with him on that. But we're at the front end about whether or not we preempt this altogether. And that's the sort of claim that Hawaii is making. If the defense is, well, you can only reach the marketing and the sale and so on that occurred within Hawaii. Okay, but that's a question about the scope of damages. That's a question about the how much of the harm can be attributed to these defendants. The reality is, insofar as they were selling and marketing their products in Hawaii, Hawaii can reach them for this, just like it could in a pharmaceutical case, and like a lot of other cases. Again, I know Richard disagrees with a lot of those precedents, but that's where we are in terms of federal preemption and whether
or not... Where we are. There's never been a single case where you just milk up something, call it tort law, and then tell the other guy you have to go through tobacco. A trial when in fact, on the face of the record, the case is worthless.
Sure we have. We've done it with tobacco. We've done other... Again,
No, but those cases were not worthless in the sense they smoked the tobacco. Well, no,
Richard, you and I agree on whether or not tort law should be arguably twisted the way Hawaii is doing it.
But it's not tort law what they're doing.
Therefore, let's grab whatever doctrine happens to be handy to get this in front of the Supreme Court to make the case go away. That's the sort of thing that we have, or you and I and others have rightfully criticized the Supreme Court for decades for doing. And that's what the plaintiffs, in my view, are doing here.
What happens in this case. I mean, I worked on the tobacco cases. Nobody denied that the people smoked tobacco. In this particular case, it's a misrepresentation case, and you couldn't figure out anything that's connected to it because there was full information. No amount of discovery will overcome that difficulty. So this is just a bogus case. I defended the type of case. No, it is not a basis for summary judgment.
I'm going to take host privileges here. For our audience, could you both, and then I'll also turn to Adam and Eddie. Could you each, in like a couple sentences, frame what you actually understand the core claims of Honolulu against the energy companies to be? Like, what precisely would the state court be hearing here?
What they've pled, and again, whether or not there are due process, I'm sympathetic to the idea that there might be issues about personal jurisdiction, although we don't see splits in the courts on that yet. I'm sympathetic to the question that this may raise due process claims because tort law has been arguably reworked here. But the claim is that the way fossil fuels were marketed by the companies failed to disclose information about the negative consequences that could result.
Marketed in Hawaii or marketed just generally? Is there something specific to Hawaii?
So the claim is marketed. Now, if it has a defense, Sunoco wants to say you can only reach our marketing in Hawaii. So therefore, we can only be responsible for this much marketing as opposed to that much marketing. Fine. But that's not the claim here. That's not what's in the cert petition. That's not what Sunoco is asking the Supreme Court to do. Sunoco is asking the Supreme Court to say Hawaii doesn't even get a chance to make its claim because of preemption. And my sole argument here is that under text, history, and precedent, there is nothing to the preemption claim, literally nothing. And in fact, the court has allowed cases to go forward and allowed the trial courts to figure out how to apply the relevant state law to the claims at issue, because that's exactly what happened in the International Paper versus Zulette case. And
Okay, so
if Congress doesn't like that, then Congress can change that. Or if there are other defenses against this litigation, due process, jurisdiction, whatever, fine. But let's not stick the square peg into the round hole because the round hole is what's in front of us.
So I understand you to be saying that the way this is framed at the Supreme Court, it's certainly not appropriate for the court to say that there's some general preemption here. But as a practical matter, it sounds like, but correct me if I'm wrong, that you may agree that ultimately Hawaii could not be awarding the scope of damages and in the broadest statement of these claims.
I'm very skeptical that Hawaii could get the sort of relief it envisions or wants in a way that is consistent with the nature of a state court jurisdiction. But I think that is the sort of thing, again, as occurred in the International Paper versus Ouellette case, that is handled at the trial court in terms of figuring out which conduct and to what extent it can be reached, not the sort of thing you invent preemption to stop.
And then let me do Adam, Eddie, and then loop back to Richard. Thoughts? What's the claim here?
Yeah, well, just in terms of what's the claim here, here's how the Hawaiian Supreme Court characterized it. This is at page 10A of the petitioner's appendix. It reads, plaintiffs bring five counts of law: public nuisance, private nuisance, strict liability, failure to warn, negligent failure to warn, and trespasses. And then the court adds, all counts rely on the same theory of liability. Defendants knew about the dangers of using their fossil fuel products, failed to warn consumers about those known dangers, and instigated a disinformation campaign to increase fossil fuel consumption, all of which exacerbated the impacts of climate change in Honolulu. So there's a few things to unpack, right? It's that there's multiple claims, but they all boil down to basically the same fact pattern and theory of liability. The claims do try to anchor it in Honolulu itself, the impacts and damages. I didn't read the case as being limited to the marketing activities in Hawaii. Now, obviously, that's all a little fluid, and I'm curious to see how Hawaii characterizes the case in court. But they seem to have swung pretty broadly in terms of the allegedly harmful conduct in terms of these energy companies' overall operations, and not just simply in Honolulu.
Eddie, how about you? How does this differ from other instances where maybe states, for example, have a particular way on social issues they want to regulate that may disagree with other states, but states go ahead and regulate it and it's fine? Here, somehow there's something about the claim that's exceeding state power. What is it that's unique here in your standpoint that's making this inappropriate for Hawaii state courts?
I think a couple things that are related. I mean, it's addressing the harm itself depends for global climate change, depends on things that have happened around the entire globe. In their complaint, they admit, this is paragraph 171, that, quote, it is not possible to determine the source of any particular individual molecule of CO2, close quote. So for the harm, I mean, the harm could be coming from, again, emissions or sales happening in Alabama or in London or China or wherever. It is a kind of fundamentally global issue. And so they're seeking equitable relief like abatement, which again is going to have to be tied to things that happen somewhere else. So to return to something we said in the brief and that I was mentioning earlier, they've got a tremendous amount of authority under the Constitution to regulate things that are happening within their own boundaries. And I believe the state of Hawaii has taken some pretty aggressive action to try to get to net zero by 2050 or something along those lines. But they don't get to project that policy choice on 49 other states.
Thanks, Eddie. Richard?
Yeah, look, I mean, let's go back to the tobacco cases or to the Hawaii cases. I defended the tobacco cases. Nobody denied that the people had smoked tobacco. Nobody denied the question of whether there might have been a duty to warn under tort law. Nobody treated these things as anything other than a standard tort case. And we argued, and we should have won on, but lost for a whole variety of technical reasons on the assumption of risk defense. Perfectly normal tort dispute. You have an automobile dispute involving a Ford car, which caused causes damages in Hawaii where they didn't sell the car. Place of the injury, there's obvious contact. You could litigate the case certainly there. But in this particular case, what happens is they claim they have a theory of misrepresentation, but you look at their complaint, they do not tell you what statements were wrong on global warming. They do not say where they have a duty to raise global warming issues. They don't even have a theory which says, hey, you told lots of things to people in other states in the same way, and when they consumed their stuff, it also raised the water levels around Honolulu. So they don't even have a theory to explain why it is they can't bring actions for every state in the universe. So my point about this is not a cause of action. This is not something which you want to resolve at trial. This is a case in which there's an instantaneous demur for saying that everything and anything that you wrote is utter waste of paper when it comes to talking about these cases. Well, if you have a non-case, then in effect, to simply say, my lawsuit says you owe me $1 billion, what's the reason why? Because you haven't paid it yet. You don't get to bring that case. It's a taking. And in this case, since there's an international situation, the argument is there is no long-arm jurisdiction because there's no consequence, no material connection to the particular case, no minimum contact with Hawaii with respect to the emissions that start to take place. Certainly no connection whatsoever to the false statements and any increase because there's full knowledge, and you know that right now. You don't have to have a trial in order to say that people warned about global warming beforehand. And in fact, if this theory works, then why aren't they, when they start using equipment and are one step closer, responsible for these harms? So the point that I'm making is this is not a tort case. This is just a phony baloney set of reactions. And if you actually look at the Hawaii Supreme Court, they do not spend a single sentence explaining to you why it is that this is a real misrepresentation case. They just said we're entitled to bring misrepresentation cases. They're not entitled to bring sham fraudulent cases before any court. And so what happens is I agree that there are always ambiguities on the preemption issue. And the argument on the other side was, well, I can't think of a single reason why if you're going to preempt the federal actions under the American Electric Power case, there's a bigger problem with respect to state actions because they could go all over the map. And so it's a much more structural argument than a textual argument. And implied preemption, which has existed since the Rice case back in 1946, may be the appropriate vehicle to do so. We've had other cases with express preemption periods, and the Supreme Court has decided to imply preemption on top of it. So I don't think Jonathan's got the law with the purity that he wants it. But the point that I was making in this particular case is you do not want to encourage cases which are outright fraudulent, utterly ruthless, to be brought in any particular court. I'm not against private rights of action for nuisance cases, I've said. I gave you the illustration of Powell before, and I agree that there should be no preemption in the Milwaukee case. But this is not that, and when you have a fake case, what you have to do is give it what it needs, which is a complete thwack. You do not want to have years of proceedings before you get phony judgment moment on essentially a phony and fraudulent kind of allegation. And that's what this is. Total bogus nonsense.
Thanks, Richard. I'm going to turn back to Adam here for a second, but I do think just again to like conceptually keep a lot of these theories in different boxes for when this case is argued, if it is. I do think that jurists like, for example, Justice Thomas, have a history where they may be paying close attention to whether we're talking about lack of government power,
yes,
or whether we're talking about preemption. And preemption, due process, all of the preemption is fundamentally actually an argument in favor of power, and it's in favor of what some folks consider the worst kind, federal power, as opposed to if the state government lacks power, which it sounds like is what you're saying when you talk about a bogus claim, that means no government entity has the power. And then, of course, the due process is a little bit different metric because that's saying, well, individual rights come in and supersede government power. So it'll be really interesting to see who takes the case and how they argue it. So Adam, I'm going to turn to you, and then I'd love us to switch to a part of the discussion where we analyze, is the petition framed in a way where the court could take its choice in what which one of these theories it wants to look at, or is it framed in such a narrow way that it actually couldn't look at due, is it unlikely to feel it could look at due process questions or lack of state power questions, or is it all fair game? But first to you, Adam, tell us how you think the case is framed best before we open it up to general discussion.
Well, thanks, Jen. And I do think it's framed primary. I mean, I could get the question presented back out in front of me, but it's framed as a preemption case. Now, of course, how far the court wants to take that question in terms of whether they grant the question as presented, whether they expand it or rephrase it. And then, you know, no matter what they do, you know, how far can the litigants go sort of expanding the field of question? That's very hard to answer. But one place where I do agree with Jonathan is that ultimately this is going to be a case about statutory text. It's not going to be about free-floating notions of preemption. I do think it is going to come down to, of course, one's general sense of the Clean Air Act, but also, as Jonathan says, the actual preemption clause or clauses. I brought up one of them in front of me, Section 7114. 7416, where the Clean Air Act is very explicit. It says that this is titled retention of state authority, and it says nothing here except where explicitly provided precludes or denies the right of any state to adopt or enforce any standard or limitation respecting emissions of air pollutants, and it goes on and on from there. So there's a couple of questions wrapped up right in that provision, and I think there's another saving clause, if I remember correctly. Jonathan might remember better than I do. But the question is whether this kind of state claim, and this goes a little bit to Richard's concerns, whether these kinds of state claims are themselves standards or limitations within the original meaning of that statute. And even if they are, then the question is, and I think this goes to both the title of that section and the lines I just read, it's whether the states had this authority to maintain this kind of claim in state court when the Clean Air Act was enacted. Is the Clean Air Act preempting something that already existed, or did it just not exist in the first place? The fact that this has to do with climate change really does complicate it, right? Because we're kind of asking ourselves, well, what did the Clean Air Act replace in terms of federal common law? What did it displace? And did that hypothetical federal common law over a climate nuisance case preempt a hypothetical state common law claim under climate law? Again, it's very hard because the chronology is weird. We're talking about stats that really precede the modern debate about greenhouse gas emissions and climate. But ultimately, I think that's what the case is going to be about, is how to interpret those preemption savings clauses against the broader backdrop of federal and state common law. And again, one sense of how any of this actually works with climate regulation, climate policy. Throughout all these climate cases, after Massachusetts versus EPA, we've seen over and over Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, being very wary of federal imposition of authority on traditional domains of state authority, right? The major questions doctrine case, the most recent one, the West Virginia case, before that, the utility air regulatory group case, repeatedly the Supreme Court's been concerned about the impacts on state authority. But it's always been concerned about the impacts of state authority over what I'd call local operations or interest, right? Very careful to not overread federal authority when it comes to existing operations or land use policies and so on within that state's authority. And the fact that we're now talking about states reaching beyond their own borders to regulate, at least that's how I think, raises a different set of questions. And it's going to cut across a lot of judicial instincts. You've already mentioned Justice Gorsuch. There's Justice Thomas. Justice Kavanaugh, who has noted his dissent in the denial of the cert petitions on some of the procedural cases, the removal remand cases. I think this is going to be a really interesting case in the Supreme Court if they take it up.
I think, Adam, I think you're right. The key question is, likely, in our view, the key question is really whether the states had this sort of authority when the Clean Air Act was enacted. And the view we stake out in our brief is that they gave up any authority to apply their own law to conduct that happens beyond their borders when they join the union. And it would make no sense to read the Clean Air Act as sort of quietly conferring upon states some brand new authority never before recognized in the history of the country To apply state law extraterritorially, it would make about as much sense to say that as to say that the Clean Air Act silently gave them the authority to send troops across state lines to shut down a power plant to fight global warming. It just doesn't add up in our view. Again, they retain authority to regulate within their borders, but not to set policy outside of their borders. And this follows from cases like BMW v. Gore. The court referenced principles of state sovereignty and comity that prevent a state from imposing economic sanctions on violators of its laws with the intent of changing the tortfeasor's lawful conduct in other states. That sounds exactly like what Honolulu was trying to do through this litigation. And it hasn't really just stopped with energy producers. We noted in our amicus brief that just a few weeks ago, New York brought a new lawsuit against JBS, the largest sort of cattle company in the world, the largest seller of beef in the world, on this theory of misrepresentations leading to climate change. And they note that different players in the agricultural sector produce large amounts or are responsible for large amounts of greenhouse gas. And so we don't think these attempts at states and local governments to try to set national and international policy are going to necessarily end with suits against the Exxons and Chevrons in the world. Will they be vanquished? These AGs will turn elsewhere to try to use it. Climate change theory to set regulatory policy for the whole country.
I think we momentarily lost Jen with some technical difficulty, so I'll take over as moderator for a little bit. And since we're all sort of ganging up on Jonathan Adler here, although he probably considers one on four, I want to give him a chance to step in. Jonathan, what's your sense of what Eddie and Richard and I have said so far about the framing of this case? Then I'll turn it back to Richard for his thoughts on how the Supreme Court might approach it.
So two things. I think one thing that's really important, and I think this is really what International Paper versus Ouellette does that we've been missing, is that there are two separate questions. One is whether or not the suit can be maintained under state law. And the second question is what substantive state law will be applied to what conduct? And what after Milwaukee 2, there certainly was language in the opinion that made us think that those two questions have to rise and fall together. That's certainly what the Seventh Circuit thought in Milwaukee 3. That's certainly what some commentators thought. But what the Supreme Court itself subsequently said in a national paper was no, they are actually distinct. And so the interstate nature of the pollutant doesn't prevent a state or a local government from being able to pursue the claim. But what it would prevent is it from extraterritorializing the substance of its tort law on conduct that occurred outside of the state. And what the Supreme Court essentially said was that that's something back at the trial court that has to be policed. So my view of what that means in a case like this is that Hawaii's case should be allowed to go forward from a preemption standpoint, but it may be the case that all Hawaii can actually get relief for is the marketing of these products and the resulting emissions in Hawaii, and then the quantum of effects in Hawaii that those things happened, provided, and I think this is a nod to Richard's point, provided that can be done at all without dramatically changing the substance of Hawaii's tort law in a way that would raise due process or other concerns about whether the producers were under notice for what was expected of them. And that may turn out to be very little or perhaps nothing. It's just a different question than is being presented here. What I think is going on, in effect, is these suits are costly. They're costly to defend. The defendants would like to make them go away. They've been very aggressive at trying all sorts of ways to make them go away. And this is another attempt to do that. But the question presented that they've put forward is, Adam, as you noted, is merely one about whether or not the interstate or international basis of the pollution is a basis for saying the suit can't go forward. And the court can't say yes without overturning International Paper versus Ouellette. And they don't ask the court to do that. And, you know, this court is one that's been very reluctant to overturn precedents without being asked to do so. So I think that's a problem in terms of the way that the case has been presented. All that said, I want to say I'm not meaning to diminish in any way some of the very real concerns that I think Richard in particular has been raising about the efforts by various politicians to kind of treat state tort law as Play-Doh that they can then shape into whatever thing they want to pursue, whatever particular political or litigation cause they want to pursue. I think those are a legitimate concern. I just fear that those concerns cause us to, you know, kind of jump the guardrails of various doctrines. And I admit that that is a concern that I have far more than Richard does. But I think that that
is... Hold on a second. Like Al Haig, I'm in charge here for now. And I want to ask one follow-up question to Jonathan before I turn it over to you.
Sure.
Appreciate your sort of nuance on all that. And I guess my follow-up question, and I might just be sensing Richard's mood on this, is this. It's one thing to say, well, let the litigation play out. Maybe the Hawaiian courts will ultimately sort of pare things down. Maybe it'll be much more reasonable. But whether it's actually settle on this and trim the case might raise due process concerns. Well taken. That might be the right way to approach it. But on the other hand, it's asking a lot of all these companies to be brought into lawsuits that might go on for years and years of discovery, and appeals, and so on, only to finally figure out at the end what the law actually is. Is there any way that kind of tailoring of the case could be front-loaded? Because I have to imagine some of that's going to be on the mind of the justices as they're thinking through how this kind of litigation acts in our federalism and in the federal framework of the Clean Air Act.
So just really say maybe, although I think this is a problem we see all the time. I mean, arguably you see this in the glyphosate litigation, arguably you see it in the talcum powder litigation, arguably you see it in other in the sense that we structure litigation such that we leave certain questions to later in the process, which creates a very powerful incentive for companies to settle, even when the underlying claims might not be all that strong. I think those are legitimate concerns. I just don't think this is the way to address it. I would also add, I think that the course of this litigation suggests that Milwaukee 2 was actually wrong. Milwaukee 2 does not represent the principle that Congress thought it was legislating against. When Congress enacted the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, the things it was legislating against as background rules were things like Georgia versus Tennessee Copper, where states or downwind or downstream entities could sue under the federal common law. And the understanding was statutes only ousted those claims to the extent they explicitly did so or created a conflict. So the Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act were enacted against the background assumption that claims could be brought for interstate pollution, that states could not do home cooking or get home field advantage by imposing their own law, but instead had to rely on the general law of the federal common law, and that would not be as favorable as to kind of innovative litigation strategies. And then the Supreme Court, in my view, if one looks at the papers at the time the court decided Milwaukee 2, the Supreme Court looked at this and said, oh my gosh, we're going to have all these original jurisdiction cases on pollution. We have them enough on water as it is, and we hate them. Can't we make them all go away? I think that was a one among many burger court innovations that we are still dealing with the negative consequences of. I would support an effort to kind of reevaluate that from the ground up. But that's not what the plaintiffs are asking for here, because reevaluating that from the ground up would say AEP goes by the wayside, and that litigation can proceed until Congress says otherwise. But I agree there's a mess here. I just don't think this is really the way it provides the real opportunity to kind of recreate everything the way perhaps, say, Stephen Sachs would tell us we should.
I feel like Richard has preempted the art of the aggressive sigh. Richard, I'm letting you jump in now.
No, I mean, I'm actually, it's my old age and lack of capacity. I'm going to make a couple of points. One of them is I want to introduce another situation, and this is a tort law consideration, which is generally speaking, when you're talking about duties to disclose, those duties are on the retailer, not on the wholesaler. And so in this particular case, if there are any local independent states in Hawaii, and there are, they can be sued under the same doctrine, but nobody, of course, brought the suit. At this particular point, the litigation can start going a bit further, because now if we're going to take this crazy theory and apply it, there's going to be an action for contribution and indemnity that all the national suppliers can give to all the local suppliers, where in fact, under this established Tate law, the manufacturers have duties with respect to quality control on the product, but the informational transformations are generally given to the downstream party. So you're going to have to deal with that in addition to everything else, and you know exactly what the Hawaii response is going to be. You can't sue our people for this stuff. We're going to give them local protection, which is a form of the kind of hypocrisy that's here. But the other point, every case that Jonathan talks to, they're cases where you're actually talking about physical harm. You're basically taking the smoke in, you're getting blown up and so forth. This is a case in which they have no harm. And they have a cause of action which is recognized in no place in the face of the globe. There's not a single effort to defend that cause of action in the Hawaii opinion. So what I'm saying is two points, and Jen, now sidelined by the microphone, she said, well, there are two claims you're making, Richard. One of them is the long-arm claim, saying that there's no significant contact. And that's right, because indeed, on their theory, even if the misrepresentations were made in Idaho, the increase in consumption in that state would affect the global economy. So you could go that far if you want to go this far. So she said, you know, okay, so that's a kind of a inherent tort law kind of claim. It's just not a valid cause of action. And then there's the long arm claim. And my attitude is I can make both these claims under these circumstances. And frankly, my dear, I think you should win on both, but not. But what you have to do is to deal with the Supreme Court, whose views on taking tend not to think about general statutes as creating taking, but only specific actions directed against a given parcel. But here's a hypothetical that you have to ask. We now have a new law of trespass in any state in the union which does not require physical entry by a defendant. Okay? And we're going to sue you for trespass for not entering, because if you had entered, you might have improved our property. All right? Well, nobody's going to allow that cause of action. And that's exactly what's going on here. So the natural law stuff that Jonathan referred to in the beginning, essentially was that Swift and Tyson was very consistent with my Roman law orientation. If you actually go back and try to find out whether there was or was not a general law, the most dominant feature was the uniformity across countries and times, where the same disputes happened in countries across it. If you're curious, I just wrote a very long, tedious argument explaining how it was that all the claims for natural law under the Roman system go all the way through without exception under international doctrine, and also animate what took place with respect to Swift against Tyson. And so if you have this, you can't kind of say, which Jonathan sort of hinted at, well, every state's free to basically create its own common law in whatever way it wants. It doesn't work like that. You may have a difference between strict liability and negligence. You may or may not use res ipsa loquitur and so forth, but the framings are much more narrow. This is outside the claim of any conceivable action that anybody has thought of anywhere, and I've yet to hear anybody say, aha, I never understood how subtle the law of misrepresentation were. And we have other cases like this that are brewing in California and so forth, where it turns out duties to speak when none required is the way in which they try to get around the requirement that you make a material misrepresentation. You can impose a duty on anybody to say anything, but it's one thing to impose it. It's another thing to find out that, for example, if you're a guardian, you have a duty to take good care of your students, but they're going to say, you're not a guardian, but we're going to impose that duty on you anyhow. And that you cannot do.
Well, I want to pose a question to the Solicitor General then. Eddie, I followed with great interest as an Iowa Hawkeye, the National Pork Producers case. And so I, frankly considered that decision a travesty against justice. Kidding, but only a little bit. We've seen the court
Me too.
Deny cert in the removal cases, where Jonathan had the better of the argument in our little back and forth on that, at least in terms of where the court ruled. What's your sense of how this issue dovetails with the current debates around the Dormant Commerce Clause and state, what I would call extraterritorial regulation? Because if this case is decided along the exact same lines as National Pork Producers, then your side of the case loses. And clearly you think this case is still in play. What do you take from the Dormant Commerce Clause case and what it means or doesn't mean for this litigation?
Yeah, I mean, we do see a different area of law, or we think there's just a whole different body of law that is implicated by this case. And again, if Hawaii tomorrow cut off all sale of gas, all marketing of gas, there were no First Amendment problems with that, at least, it could potentially have a big impact on the national gas market. And there's a lot California can do, obviously, because of its huge market share. But again, I don't really see what Honolulu is trying to do here through its court system as really of a piece with that. I mean, there may be similar goals and maybe trying to change what's going on outside of the state, but the means for doing so are completely different. And so we don't think that pork producers creates a hindrance to the argument that's being put forward by the energy producers here or by the states for that matter. Because I mean, I think it's still a court that does recognize the important federalism issues. And we've got cases like Hyatt from just a few terms ago, recognizing that one state can't sue another in the plaintiff state's court. Because mm-hmm. again, there are certain aspects of sovereignty that had to be ceded to have a harmonious union, and so again, we do think this is a great vehicle and potentially a rare one because this came up on interlocutory appeal. A lot of other cases are percolating in other courts, but they may not get up to the court until years and years go by. In the meantime, it does just take one judge to enter some sort of preliminary injunctive relief that could create a nationwide emergency. So we think the stakes are very high here, and this is a great opportunity for the court to provide clarity.
Excellent. So I'm going to turn back to Richard. And just a quick apology. I am not in my normal D.C. area perch today, but north of Baltimore dealing with a serious family health thing. So apologies on the tech.
Family duties always take priority. Look, I'm going to talk about this. I regard the pork case as one of the great intellectual disasters in the history of the United States Supreme Court, and have written so. The question is, it's again, the reason why it's relevant in this case, and I hope you're right, Ed, that it's not going to be treated as such, is because there's a serious extraterritorial operation in this case. We are trying to tell Arkansas, if you want to sell any goods into our particular state, what you have to do is to comply with our safety requirements, and we're not even sure that they're the better safety requirements. And so immediately the second question is, if California can do one thing, then maybe Nevada can do another thing. You get 49 different sets of rules, and nobody could comply with all of them simultaneously, which is a very strong reason why you don't want to do it. So then the question is, can California protect its interests since we're engaged in balancing tests with lesser stuff? And the answer to that question is most emphatically yes. All it has to say is if somebody wants to ship something into California that doesn't conform to California rules, they say the raising of these particular pigs does not conform to California law. You may buy or not buy. And at that point, you could give different messages to each of the 50 states, but otherwise not. There was another question that was unanswered in that case, and the reason they didn't answer is they didn't have the courage of their convictions to do so. And so the next state says, you cannot sell your pork in California unless you have a $20 minimum wage law and you agree to take a union whose stuff is going to be governed by California law. They said, well, what do you do about that? Nobody wanted to answer that question, but it's not distinguishable from the previous question. And the correct answer is no. You can't do that at all. And what you could do is have the same disclosure remedy. But at this particular point, if you treat it as a two-party dispute, you're missing everything about state relationships where there are 49 other states, each with its own inconsistent requirements. And so you never, ever allow that to happen. And the reason why this is important is that it turns out that the poor case gives a state enormous influence to exert extraterritorial influence that it does not not deserve to have. And same on Justice Gorsuch for saying you don't balance when you're doing dormant commerce clause work, which he said both in the Tenth Circuit and the Supreme Court. You always have to balance whether you're a judge or whether you're a lawyer. And in this particular case, the balance is easy. So I'm worried about the fact that somebody's going to say that form of interventionism is okay, so we could do the nutty things that they want to do in this particular case. We're organizing at the Classical Liberal Institute a conference on extraterritoriality because it has become a real major sticking point with respect to how it is you organize this, not only with respect to states, but also with respect to territories, like, you know, Guam, American Samoa, Puerto Rico, Philippines, and a lot of other cases. And I think, in effect, we've gone very far off the map.
Okay, thank you, Richard. I'm going to let Jonathan answer, but also we should let our audience know about timing. I mean, the response hasn't actually even been filed.
I'll just say I have concerns about extraterritoriality. I'm not sure whether they're best addressed under the Dormant Commerce Clause or the Due Process Clause. I think those concerns have application here. I might think that those limitations are more appropriate in the Due Process Clause than in the Commerce Clause. But in any event, I think those are reasonable concerns. You know, I do make this appeal for respecting the limits of different doctrines and not having them kind of bleed over into one another, or thinking that we can kind of do a penumbra and emanation thing where we blend them together. I think that leads to a lot of mischief and should not entertain that. I do think, all that said, the outcome of the National Pork Producers case, combined, I think, with the outcome of the Mallory case, suggests that on the right side of the court, the sort of concern for the effect that states flexing their authority has on interstate businesses is less than what historically we assumed from what we might characterize as conservative justices. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I think just as a descriptive matter, we do see a bit of a generational shift on the court in that way. And I think that likely affects the way the justices might evaluate a case like that.
I hope not. This is also true in oil states. Same problem. On the question of putting things back to the PTO. Yes, because it's exactly the same question of how it is that you distribute power, and they're willing to essentially allow the federal government much discretion in the way in which it allocates branches amongst the federal government, which is the same problem intellectually at the bottom as to much too much discretion in national pork and much too much discretion here.
Not seeing the conceptual difference between granting versus taking a patent, but we'll see. We'll see. I think Mallory and the court is moving more to structural ideas and principles, and it is a shift, and sometimes it's leading to outcomes that are different than how they would have been a few years ago. On timing, so the response hasn't yet even been filed in this case. I think the extension was granted until Wednesday of this week.
It has only accepted 8 cases for argument for next term, 4 of which it accepted this morning. Even assuming this isn't isn't heard for conference until the fall, which I think is reasonable, there will be plenty of time on the spring docket if the court kind of sticks to its current trajectory in terms of the rate at which it's granting cases.
Thanks, everybody.
This has been an episode of Gray Matters. If you enjoyed this discussion, check out all of our episodes on our website at administrativestate.gmu.edu. You can also follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @AdLawCenter.